Blog Talk Radio.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
While many of us are stuck at home, that second slow pandemic continues to unfold. Miami suffered through 97 degrees Fahrenheit, 36 degrees C, an absolute record for April. Northern Europe is dry to drought, just when the spring rain should be watering new crops. The Copernicus Climate Change Service reports 2019 was the warmest year ever recorded in Europe. In fact, 11 of the 12 warmest years there have happened since the year 2000. Europe has already gone above the 2 degrees C warming, the supposed red line for climate safety. Now, a report from the U.S. Geological Survey finds extreme flooding will double every 5 years. Those 50-year floods, those once-in-a-lifetime events, those will become the new normal. You will hear from that study author Sean Vatusek. It's not just that hundreds of billions of dollars of coastal real estate is about to crash that market, and maybe all markets, or that all the underground infrastructure in major coastal cities from Miami to New York are going under, like the subways, the pipes, it's all going to go to the salty water. The whole appearance of coastlines will have to be remapped, as up to half of beaches disappear and cliffs fall into the sea. Essential wetlands go salty and species go extinct. Even as city streets appear empty of cars, though, and greenhouse gases from humans continue into the atmosphere. We continue to burn coal, oil, and gas. We are building on top of a carbon load a century deep. We are heading into nearly unsurvivable heat and violent weather. Nobody can just put that off for a year or two while we struggle with the novel virus. We already wasted any years of grace a couple of decades ago. Now every year is a climate emergency into the foreseeable future because we have lied to ourselves so effectively. I mean, look at the wonders of space travel, computers and chemicals and pharmaceuticals. Of course, humans will find a technology to reverse climate damage and return to safety. Except, we have no such technology and no guarantee of any. Just the promise of a technical fix is what got us into irreversible trouble now. Remember when nuclear fusion was the answer? Or blocking out the sun? How about running a million fans to cool the Arctic sea ice? All the tech daydreams were included in climate models, in political plans, and in climate negotiations. Our first guest, Professor Duncan McLaren, explains why technical delusions are so dangerous when we really need social change. I'm Alex Smith. Yes, I'm preparing for a deep economic crash, for the next Great Depression. Our greenhouse is stocked. We have expanded our planting area. The new chickens have already started to lay. But you and I cannot be blinded by one emergency, so we miss the next one coming. Let's keep our eyes on climate change and our voices calling for action to flatten the curve of abrupt and disruptive warming here on the home planet. As Greta Thunberg said on Earth Day this year,
I mean, it's always important, essential that we listen to the science and to the experts, but during crises like this, it is even more important that we listen to scientists, to science, and to the experts. That goes for all crises, whether it's the corona crisis or whether it's the climate crisis, which of course is still ongoing and is not slowing down even in times like these. Today is Earth Day, and that reminds us that the climate and environmental emergency is still ongoing. We need to tackle both the corona pandemic, this crisis, at the same time as we tackle the climate and environmental emergency, because we need to be able to tackle two crises at once. And yeah, we are right now in the year 2020, and 2020 we have known since 2017 that this is a crucial year, that at the latest 2020 the emission curve must have been bended steep downwards if we are to have a chance to stay below the 1.5 degrees of global average temperature rise. So we are right now in this very crucial year, and the corona pandemic has turned, I think, I'm safe to say it has turned everything upside down. So the question is then, how do we act from this and how do we move on? What are the possible ways forward?
Radio EcoShock.
Remember all those fabulous technical fixes that were going to save us from disastrous climate change? The world would run on nuclear fusion or oil made from algae, while thousands of wind pumps saved the sea ice. The world is still waiting and still heating up. A new paper from experts at UK's Lancaster University collects the promises and failures of technical fixes, plus the ways all those shiny ideas help governments and corporations avoid the hard part, real social and economic change needed to limit climate change. The paper is called The Coevolution of Technological Promises, Modeling, Policies, and Climate Change Targets. We reached the lead author, Duncan McLaren, professor and research fellow at Lancaster, UK. Professor McLaren, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, a pleasure to be joining you.
At first, I thought your paper might be a bit technical for policy wonks, but really, it is a shocking summary of how we all lied to ourselves about climate change. In the policy brief, you used the slightly milder word prevarication, but the results are the same. A lot of promotion of technology and more hot air. Why did you write this?
We wrote this primarily because we were looking at some of these newer technological promises, the idea that we could, or that people could suck carbon out of the air with what are called negative emission technologies, and that this would, sometime later in this century, we'd be doing so much of this that we would be able to restore the climate. And in our work on that, we found that these technologies were being taken up in the modelling communities that look at how we could deal with climate change, and that what seemed to happen was that as a result of these things being available in maybe 2050 or 2070, there was less action happening in the models right now in the 2020s. And we thought, that's interesting. And my colleague, Nils Markussen, who I co-wrote this paper with, said, well, that's something that we saw a hint of with this previous technological promise, this idea of carbon capture and storage, the idea that we could put a sort of filter on big polluting power plants, take the carbon out of the gas, the flue gas that's been emitted, compress it and store it away somewhere. And we looked at those too, and we found, yeah, indeed, that's exactly what happened, again, in the models. So we don't think this is, if you like, a deliberate thing. The modelers aren't saying, oh, how can we slow things down? What they're saying is, how can we make it the cheapest possible way of meeting the target that politicians are asking us to meet? And if what you can do is put some future technology in that looks cheap in the model because the models discount future costs, standard economic technique, then the model itself will in the background churn away and replace anything that looks expensive, like, I know, constraining air travel or constraining car use in the short term. So that was what really got us into it, was this sort of succession that we saw over a couple of different technologies. Then it all got more complicated. What we found was that these were not just related to technological promises, but that some of these promises were created by the models. So we have this technology called BECCS. It's a bioenergy with carbon capture and storage. And the promise here is that we, for instance, burn timber in a big power station, and then we strip the carbon out of the flue gas and capture it and pipe it away and bury it. But BECCS didn't even exist when it started moving into the models. The models had bioenergy as a standalone technology, and they had carbon capture and storage. And this was a really easy way for modelers to move from cutting emissions to removing carbon from the atmosphere. And one of the reasons they were encouraged to do that was that we'd started talking not about emissions cuts as the climate target, but as some measure of atmospheric concentration of carbon, which emissions cuts can only do so much for. If we overshoot that, then all the cuts in emissions in the world still don't bring it back down. It takes these negative emission technologies to bring it back down. In the end, we tried to look back right to the start of climate policy to see if we could find more examples.
And we'll talk about those, but you know, you've just pressed one of my buttons. You talk about bioenergy, and when it was produced as a solution to reduce emissions, the Netherlands bought palm oil from plantations carved out of endangered Indonesian rainforests, and Britain is still pushing wood pellets as green power plants, while my friend Maria Gallardon is fighting off yet another pellet plant in Northern California, cutting down the redwoods and valuable forests there for so-called green energy across the seas. It really seems to have harmed our climate progress rather than helped it.
Certainly there are very big problems with a lot of bioenergy. In theory, it's a benefit for the climate, but in practice, what we often see is that the sort of cheapest and simplest sources of bioenergy are ones that involve extracting wood or oil from primary forests, so cutting down primary forests to plant palm oil plantations. And in these ways, the pursuit of bioenergy, particularly biofuel to fuel vehicles, but bioenergy more generally, has led to negative impacts on the climate. I mean, the estimates for palm oil is that if peat swamps are drained to plant palm plantations, it's 600 years worth of emissions that are made as a result of that swamp being drained. So it's a long time before that bioenergy makes a net positive effect, even discounting the impacts on biodiversity and wildlife that arise from that action. So, we have to be very careful in thinking that bioenergy at all is a positive solution, regardless of whether we then match it up with carbon capture and storage. The way this illustrates the problem we found so well is that this imaginary of big power plants burning lots of often wood pellets or wood and the CO2 being captured and stored away, it's still in the models. There's still huge amounts of it in many models of how we're going to get to our climate targets. The reality of BECCS is that there are a few small-scale plants, and they're bioethanol plants out there in the US, particularly, which are fermenting corn to make biofuel. And what that in that fermentation process, there's a lot of carbon dioxide produced, and it's fairly easy and cheap to capture the carbon dioxide that comes off the fermentation. That's about half of the carbon in the fuel. The rest of the carbon stays in the liquid fuel that's produced and is still pumped out the tailpipe of the vehicle that burns that ethanol-based fuel. The half that's captured is sent down a pipeline, but it's almost every case, it's sent down a pipeline to be pumped into an oil field where it's used to produce more oil. So the idea of BECCS, the imaginary is this carbon negative technology with sustainable wood plantations, and the reality is of a climate multiplying technology using ethanol and enhanced oil recovery.
And what happened to the nuclear solution to end greenhouse gas emissions? All during the 1990s, that's what I heard about. But it seems to have enabled climate inaction. And what happened to the promise of nuclear fusion, generating power too cheap to meter?
Well, nuclear fusion, I worked for several years on an advisory committee that was looking at energy solutions for the UK. And we had a standing joke there, which was that nuclear fusion was 40 years away, and it had been 40 years away for the last 40 years. So this was obviously a code for, we don't really believe it. Still, there's a lot of investment going into it, and the best hope seems to be that maybe in 30 years rather than 40 years, there will be nuclear fusion that can be sustained for, a few seconds, maybe a few minutes. So not commercial fusion power. Yet Boris Johnson, well, he might have changed his mind. There's a lot else on it at the moment. But a few months ago was touting nuclear fusion as the way that Britain would become net zero carbon emitter. So the promises are still there. The reality of fusion is still somewhere out there in the future. Wouldn't be a bad thing to achieve, but it would be a very bad thing to rely on it.
Well, personally, I believe a great angel will come down on Britain and bless her so that the carbon will go away. It has about the same real effect now as we pile up our emissions every year. It makes me a little angry, and I have to. Here's another one that gets me. Every IPCC report that I've seen in the 2000s has explicitly counted on something you mentioned, carbon reductions through carbon capture and storage. And there were a few real-world attempts, as you say, and they all failed. Nothing's risen even close to the scale we need. I worry that the fraud of CCS, which it is to me, has been severely damaging to the future. I guess your opinion's a little more moderate than that.
Well, I mean, broadly, I think you're right. It is another example of a promise which made the models add up, made it look as if we were on course, even when all that was being done was at best very marginal improvement. I mean, there are improvements. Don't get me wrong here. It's not that no country has reduced emissions. It's not that many countries have improved the sort of economic intensity of their emissions. They've made a relative decoupling of their economies from carbon emissions. There are signs of hope. But carbon capture and storage, again, as it was foreseen, was this thing that we would put on, particularly on coal-fired power stations, to allow us to go on using coal for many years, but cut the emissions from it by 80 or 90%. And it emerged first in an era when we talked about targets in terms of emissions cuts. It was sustained in an era when we talked about targets in terms of concentrations. And partly that was, I think, because of an initiative that started in California to talk about emissions performance standards. And carbon capture and storage was pushed very heavily then as a way for power companies to meet these future emissions performance standards. What's happened, though, is that it remained a promise. This is one area where Nilsi's previous work was really insightful. He and other colleagues pointed out that for the industry, the fact that it was so expensive and could be continually deferred was valuable to them. It meant they could go on saying, yeah, we're going to do that, but we can't afford it now. We have to go on running these power plants as they are. Fortunately, a lot of those have since been closed because they've become uneconomic anyway. And the idea that we're going to have large-scale carbon capture and storage on coal plant when new coal plant or even existing coal plant is not competitive with solar PV today is laughable. Sadly, what that means is we probably won't get carbon capture and storage technology to match up with bioenergy, even at a small scale. I'm not arguing we should do BECCS at the scale the models predict, but that a proportion of that, 20% of it, 30% of it, perhaps could be done sustainably and safely, and that would be a contribution to drawing down carbon from the atmosphere. But if CCS has to be developed and paid for just for doing that, we're going to have the same problem. Again, the people running bioenergy plants are going to say, well, why should we pay the costs of installing all of this? We can't afford to do that. We'll just, at worst, we'll just stop operating. So, yeah, the CCS story is not over yet. I still hear people talk about gas-fired power stations as being CCS-ready. This idea that you build a power station and or you have a power station and you could add CCS to it when the technology becomes affordable. I used to work in Scotland, and probably a bit unfair of me to name them, so I won't, but a very large power generation company with a very large power station, someone from that said, yeah, the plant's CCS ready. What we joke in the industry that means is it has a large car park. In other words, it has an adjacent site on which you could build a CCS plant if you could afford to.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Professor Duncan McLaren from Lancaster University. We're talking about the many ways humans imagine they are solving the huge threat of climate change while we still rocket faster and faster towards disaster. It is tiring to me, Duncan, that each new pipe dream is heavily promoted in mainstream media and even the science press. They get some good drawings or some science fiction photos. They never fall off on the fact that the bright headlines did not work. Don't you think that media hype is part of the problem?
I think hype is part of the problem. The challenge, and to be absolutely frank with you, one of the things we'd like to do as researchers going forward is to try and disentangle valuable hype that brings an idea to attention, get some focus on it, get some funding on it to it, from excessive hype that leaves the public thinking that they don't need to do other things, or politicians thinking that they don't need to do other things because this particular new technology is going to be so great. This, I think, brings us around to the, if you like, the key message, which is I don't think any of these technologies are going to help us much until we think about them politically and we think about them culturally and we start to change the way our social and behavioral system adopts technologies. Otherwise, they get deployed at best, like the BEX example, as a marginal tweak to existing systems. So BECs being adopted to create more carbon dioxide to put into enhanced oil recovery. That's exactly how the modern capitalist system likes its innovations. What it doesn't like is something that sweeps away lots of existing investments, and that's actually what we need. We need to sweep away large amounts of investment in fossil fuels, large amounts of investment in fossil fuel power, if we're going to meet the climate goals we've set ourselves.
So, Duncan McLaren, what do you think about geoengineering?
Well, geoengineering is almost where I came into this. I've been looking at the justice implications of geoengineering for my late career PhD, which I finished a few years ago. And people talk about geoengineering in different ways. So let me say, I think of geoengineering as including these very large-scale ideas of carbon removal. It's one form of geoengineering. We're doing something after too much carbon has been emitted. That's really what distinguishes geoengineering from other responses to climate change problem. But there's also this category of geoengineering called solar geoengineering, where the aim is to mask or limit the impacts of climate change by some huge intervention. Again, once there's already too much carbon in the atmosphere and the Earth's heating up. So the principal idea here is that we could somehow spread a veil of fine particles high in the stratosphere that would shade out some of the incoming sunlight. And lots of different ways that that's been suggested. I am agnostic about the idea of researching this. I understand that there are potential circumstances where climate impacts could be getting so bad that we might as a species want to consider this. But as a technological promise, I think it's one of the most pernicious. It's one that offers the potential for doing nothing else, for going on sweating the fossil assets as long as possible, using as much coal as possible. And that's why it didn't surprise me when I was last year at the UN Environment Assembly, talking to delegates there from different countries about their views on a proposal to regulate geoengineering, it didn't surprise me to find some countries that were opposed to that idea of regulating geoengineering. And at the forefront of those, unsurprisingly, was Saudi Arabia. So countries that wanted to use existing fossil fuel assets, profit from them, were the most ready to have geoengineering as an option in their future toolkit. They didn't want it regulated away. They didn't want it prevented from being available. Fortunately, when most individuals hear about geoengineering ideas, they go, that is nuts. That is such a bad idea. How would we know what effects it might have? And it actually seems to make most ordinary people more enthusiastic about taking action to cut emissions. So that's the positive side. You know, one thing, though, bring it back into the sort of theme of the paper and why we mention it in the new paper, is that geoengineering, certainly solar geoengineering as a climate solution, obviously has no impact on emissions levels. It has no impact on carbon budgets, these different ways we talk about climate targets. But we've started now in the last few years talking about climate targets in terms of the outcome temperature. So all about whether it should be 2 degrees C or 1.5 degrees C or possibly even a smaller amount above the pre-industrial level. And in that terminology, solar geoengineering becomes a valid promise for how we might intervene in the climate problem. So we see how the way we politically construct the target and the technological promise evolve together.
Duncan, what do you see as the wildest solution apparently taken seriously by some politicians, the media, or the public?
Oh, at the moment, I think some of the attention being given to ideas such as underwater dams to prevent the ice breaking off the Antarctic, or these sort of wind pumps to pump colder water up from deep levels to try and protect the Arctic ice. I can see why scientists start to talk about these things, because they're worried about the systemic effects of losing those ice caps, not just the slow sea level rise, but the feedbacks that come when the white ice is no longer reflecting sunlight as much as it does at present. But the idea that interventions like that are anything more than a marginal and indeed last gasp desperate effort to protect a particular element of the system is a bit wild. The other one that keeps coming back, it's a bit of a zombie, is the idea of ocean fertilization. And we've recently had one of the ex-chief scientific advisors in the UK talking about this as a sensible idea. And the idea is that we should grind up lots of iron down into very fine particles and spread it out in the oceans to deliberately cause an algal bloom, and then hope that the algae die and take the carbon that they've absorbed in growing down to the bottom of the ocean.
We just had a Canadian named Russ George try that off the coast of British Columbia, dump the iron in the sea. He's not a scientist, didn't have government permission. In fact, the government told him not to do it. But I looked into it as well. We've done multiple shows on it here on Radio EcoShock. We've looked at the early experiments in the 1990s by New Zealand and a group of countries, and they found really there was no way to tell whether it was working or not. So it does seem like a dead end to me.
Yeah, it seemed like the Rust George experiment possibly increased fish numbers, which would have been a nice side benefit. But as you say, there's no way to tell whether that the algae that formed would have simply formed somewhere else if the iron filings hadn't been put there. That's a lot of what the scientists are saying, that the downstream effects, in the huge uncontained ocean, we just don't know. And most likely there's an offset. And secondly, we really don't know how much of that gets to the bottom of the ocean. And interestingly, the more of it that ends up in fish and gets caught, the less of it clearly ends up at the bottom of the ocean.
One final sort of thing is that the pessimists think that this complex carbon civilization, it's making big technical promises like carbon capture and storage. You'd have to build another whole pipeline system as big as the existing oil pipeline system to make that happen. We think that the big technical civilization might collapse long before those goals we set for 2050, much less the end of the century. Surely that calls for more humility in the face of natural forces and in obvious human weakness shown to us by history.
Indeed. I mean, I think humility is one of the key words we need to have as a watchword in this situation. We need to be much more precautionary about what we do. We have known for decades, I would argue, that we can cut emissions to a sustainable level by changing behaviours, by using and deploying some classic existing technologies. We have the ability to build houses that are passive, that don't need energy to heat them. We have the ability to get around our towns and cities with public transport and bicycles and on foot. We can build a low-carbon civilization as long as we're prepared to invest in changing the ways we live as human beings. And I would argue that they're ways that make us more human, that always ask for the collective solution, the collaborative solution, rather than trying to sustain an economy that's based on individualism and competition.
Yes, you've called for transformative social and economic change, and in a way we are seeing just a little template of that right now due to COVID, as the oil economy has been shut down and you can't give away oil. So maybe this is a chance for us to turn in a better direction.
It certainly gives us a moment to reflect, I think, on what it is that really makes us human and what it is we value about our society, so that we can try to build a more sustainable future for ourselves and our children.
We've been speaking with Professor Duncan McLaren, professor and research fellow at Lancaster University in the UK. Find links to his paper, The Coevolution of Technological Promises, Modeling, Policies, and Climate Change Targets, in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Duncan, thank you for spending valuable time with us.
It's been a pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Once in a lifetime, record high seas can flood into cities and wash away coastlines. It's big news. But new research shows that within 30 years or so, that extreme could be the new normal. Rising seas are the relentless new story for the rest of our lives. Dr. Sean Vatusek is a research oceanographer with the Pacific Coastal and Marine Science Center, part of the U.S. Geological Survey. Sean is co-author of the new paper, Sea Level Rise Exponentially Increases Coastal Flood Frequency. From Santa Cruz, California, Sean Vatusek, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, let's bring this home. If we have a place in an American coastal city, what does your new research tell us about the occasional flooding we may have seen?
Yeah, well, we looked at a lot of data from tide gauges at different cities across the U.S. to analyze the sort of statistics of the extreme water levels. And what we find is that the difference between some of the extreme water levels and some of the more commonplace water levels, like high tide, for a lot of locations around the U.S., isn't that different in elevation. about 75% of the locations around the U.S., there's only about a 3-foot difference between these 50-year extreme water levels. You know, that is extreme water levels that are likely to occur once every 50 years and high tide levels that occur every day. So when you're looking at sea level projections that often exceed 3 feet by 2100, we've got this pretty impressive shift in coastal flood regimes and the potential for frequent coastal flooding that's going to happen relatively soon.
Last year, I spoke with the grand old man of coastal science, Dr. Oren Pilkey, and he worried the story of rising seas would focus on damage to big cities while long stretches of the coastal ecology are just washed away by rising seas. What do your models tell us about this?
I do two different things sort of in my job with the USGS. One is sort of look at these sea level impacts to urban areas and flooding. But also I do a lot of coastal change modeling that is predicting erosion on long, open, sandy beaches using different models than the one that I showed in this particular study. And I have a lot of collaborators at different institutions that look more at the sort of ecological aspects. Just to give a quick example, you know, there's a lot of endangered snowy plover habitat in northern Monterey Bay that lay their eggs just sort of right seaward of the sand dunes. And if you have a lot of beach erosion, which is related to sea level rise, then some of their habitat, basically nesting habitat, can go away. So that's just one small example. But with sea level rise, you have this problem of increased urban flooding and beach erosion, so loss of beach access and damage to habitats. While urban flooding is a big one and requires a lot of attention, I think those other ecological aspects and impacts don't necessarily receive as much attention, but are perhaps equally as important.
Yes, you also published a paper on coastal cliff retreat. What does that mean? And is it possible the shorelines will change so much that it could be hard to recognize them 50 or 70 years from now?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a study that I worked on a few years ago basically showed that if you have sea level projections on the low end of around a meter and the high end around 2 meters, well, that could cause the loss of, you know, between a third and two thirds of the beaches in California, meaning that there's essentially no beach and you have water right up against the edge of the cliffs where there used to be beaches. And so the loss of those beaches can potentially mean that cliff erosion and erosion rates can accelerate. You know, you get into some interesting challenges with, you know, a lot of clifftop property potentially becoming damaged. It's possible that the coastline may look very, very different than it does today with future sea level rise scenarios of a meter or 2 meters, almost to the point where you can't even recognize sort of the beaches where you grew up at.
I was surprised when Oren Pilkey told us it was time to start withdrawing from the coastline. Now he said we should not wait for a panic and an emergency. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's difficult to say what we should do going forward. You know, sea level rise is a slow process, so I think that's why we're really playing the waiting game. But I think in certain locations, you know, those managed retreat options about really considering, you know, we just got to get out of the way. I think trying to consider that option, I think, is really appropriate.
Well, just as a reality check here, what is different about the models employed by your team? And did you cross-check against actual tide gauge data that we know for sure?
Yeah, so in this particular paper, the one about coastal flooding, all of it essentially comes from real observed data. And that was something that we really wanted to do just because, you know, when we have all this data, we might as well really look at the data and tell us, you know, what are we going to expect if we see this same sort of variability in terms of extreme events that we've observed in the past. And the only additional factor that increases our susceptibility is the sea level rise. So essentially in this particular study, what we did was we looked at all of the historical tide gauge data going back to about 1950, and there are almost 900 tide stations around the U.S. So we limited our analysis to tide gauges that had at least a few decades of data. So we analyzed that tide gauge to really show, like, what are the historical events, and based on those, what is a good prediction for a water level event that we likely experience once every 50 years?
I wondered to myself, does this paper really include storm surges? And then I see that in 2016 you co-authored a paper on extreme wave and storm surges. Are events like super high waters during hurricanes included in your projections in this paper?
Yes, they are. Storm surges are a very difficult thing to deal with because they are rare events. But because, you know, we're using actual data from stations all along the East Coast and all along the Gulf Coast, the current regime or the current patterns of tropical cyclones are manifested in that actual data. You know, we see hurricane events in each of those tide gauge records. And so the statistics of the extreme water levels include those events. However, what we're not including in this study is any potential changes in frequency, intensity, or storm tracks going forward into the future. There are a lot of people that are modeling those events, but they're very difficult to model. And still, it's unclear on what the effect of future climate is on tropical cyclones. But in terms of the historical behavior of tropical cyclones, if you make the assumption that in the future we will see a pattern of tropical cyclones that is consistent with the historical behavior, then that effect is included in our results.
In a presentation you gave in Hawaii in 2019, you stressed the extreme risk of rising seas in the tropics. Where are those risks and why there?
Yeah, so the tropics have interesting behavior in terms of, if you look at the statistics of the extreme water level events, the extreme water levels in those locations are relatively consistent in terms of their magnitude. There's very limited sort of variability about the extreme events. The magnitude of their extreme events is relatively low, but also the variance of those extreme events is relatively low. And when you have sea level rise and you have extreme events where the magnitude of those extreme events is relatively low, then sea level rise represents a very large percentage compared to the magnitude and the variance of those extreme events. So in some cases, tens of centimeters of sea level rise may increase, you know, the magnitude of the extreme events by 20, 30, 40%. Whereas if you go to more high latitude regions that have much larger extreme events, then tens of centimeters of sea level rise may only increase that by about 5 or 10%. So it's really the percentage that sea level rise increases the magnitude of those extreme events that makes the tropics particularly vulnerable.
So are we talking like the Caribbean or where?
Yes, Caribbean, Hawaii, also other tropical, you know, U.S. territories like Guam, Marshall Islands, even low-lying, low-latitude continental areas, Southern California, Gulf Coast, Galveston, Miami, places like that.
In 2017, I interviewed a young scientist, Pankaj Khanna, from Rice University, and his team said plateaus of drowned coral reefs showed seas can rise suddenly in steps rather than just a gradual annual increase. So what happens to a relatively conservative model if sea level rise is not gradual and predictable, but maybe happens in sudden bursts like an Antarctic ice shelf breaks off or something like that?
Yes, I've been thinking about that a fair amount. I haven't done any particular research myself on that, so I'll definitely have to get your reference for that paper and take a look. So like you said, most of the sea level curves that we deal with are very smooth, but I don't know, historically speaking, how much that's realistic. Like you said, you know, if you have this big failure of some ice sheet, that could probably almost instantly cause sea level rise to go up by a good amount with some adjustment period after that ice sheet falls in. To say how that relates to our study, we tried to look at it in two different ways. We tried to understand how much sea level rise increases the frequency of flooding and how much the frequency of flooding increases over time. And by looking at everything over time, we generally assume a smooth curve based on popular projections. But you could also, if you had a stepwise increase, if you had an incremental increase in sea level rise of 5 or 10 centimeters based on some failure, then based on that stepwise increase, you could predict the flooding changes over time, which is not something that we do, but I think it's a very interesting thing. I personally wonder what is sort of the thing that is going to really motivate us to take action about sea level rise. And I think if we had a big failure of some ice sheet in Antarctica or something like that, I think a lot of people are studying that really carefully, and they might know specifically after a failure happens that this particular event in the next few years will basically cause 10 centimeters of sea level rise. I think people would really be like, okay, this is something that's pretty serious.
Well, you know, I'm going to look into that more myself to see how long the lag time would be for a big ice shelf to fall in before it actually shows up on our shores. I'm not sure of that myself.
Yeah, no, I think that's an interesting concept that I've thought about too, because if you think about it, if you have a big floating iceberg, that big floating iceberg, when it melts, you know, doesn't increase sea level rise. It's basically the water from land-based ice that needs to go in to increase sea level rise. But if you had something like an ice sheet, about this kind of like thin little sheet that's attached to a continental landmass, and that sheet, which is kind of partially floating, but also a big majority of it is connected to a landmass, once that thing fails, it essentially becomes an iceberg. And when it's an iceberg and it melts, it doesn't contribute to increasing sea level. So the fact of that thing falling in basically makes your sea level rise go up in a step amount, but there has to be some oceanographic adjustment to that thing that takes place over a long time period. And I don't know if there's been studies on that, but it would cause sort of an incremental increase in sea level rise, but I'm not sure over what time scale. I don't think it would be very long. I think probably on the order of a few years or something like that.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Sean Vatusek from the U.S. Geological Survey. I've spoken with scientists who think 1 meter sea level rise by the end of this century, as generally accepted by the IPCC, that is far too conservative. People like NASA scientist James Hansen said seas could be up to 3 meters higher, coming faster. What do you think? Does your study include that higher possibility or not?
Yeah, so we looked at three pretty standard sea level rise scenarios based on emission scenarios, and those are basically these representative concentration pathways scenarios used by the IPCC, the 2.6, which is the low end, the 4.5, which is kind of the intermediate, and the 8.5, which is sort of the business as usual. And so those range from something like a half a meter at the low end to probably about a meter and a half on the high end. And each of those scenarios are probabilistic. However, we've mostly focused our results on sort of the ensemble median projections, which correspond to about a half a meter, 1 meter, and 1.5 meters by 2100. And all of these projections vary spatially, and we account for those spatial variations in our study. But the possibility of sea level rise scenarios that exceed 2 meters or something like that, I think is a possibility. We focused on those individual scenarios in our study, but I think it really just comes down to the failure of these large land-based ice masses, which is very difficult to sort of predict. But personally, I think considering those high-end sea level scenarios is something that we really need to consider in terms of our modeling results and giving results on potential vulnerability to those large sea level scenarios. I think it's critical to present the full range of possibilities, and then the decision makers can really understand what is the sort of maximum that we should start planning for. And I think 2 meters is appropriate to do that.
But even with a median scenario, you have said when rare floods become the new normal, quote, this may render some parts of the U.S. coastline uninhabitable. That sounds pretty extreme. Can you explain?
This is coming from the business as usual scenario, which is about maybe 1.4, 1.5 meters of sea level rise. We basically said that phrase because we found that since it's only about a meter difference between the 50-year extreme water level, what's considered present day, and mean high water, then with those sea level rise scenarios, you get into a situation potentially where just your daily high tide that you experience almost every day can exceed the extreme 50-year threshold. And so essentially without some, you know, mitigation efforts to fully armor the shoreline, you're going to have flooding events with the potential to flood the cities, to close streets at low-lying areas near the waterfront every day. As you can imagine, if you had a major city that basically had 2 feet of water on every city street for several hours a day with only a little bit of relief when you had a low tide event over the course of a couple hours, life in that city would be pretty much impractical, if not impossible. You know, if you're thinking about the movie Waterworld and all this, you know, sea level rise is not to the point where you're going to be able to flood all of the land mass on Earth. But if you took all your cities and you flooded them with 2 or 3 feet of water almost persistently, you'd get sort of a different type of a water world type movie, which doesn't look like the cities right now.
Yeah, most of our cities have a lot of underground infrastructure. And I'm not just talking about the Big Dig in Boston or the subways in New York, both of which will flood. But, you know, all the wires and the pipes and everything that we count on is under there. And
sewer systems and things like that, yeah. Just to elaborate, I think also, you know, the water quality issues associated with all of this, you know, sewer systems and cesspools and things like that, you know, this is not just your beach water that you go down at the beach. You know, this is some pretty bad water that can be in the streets pretty frequently. You know, Honolulu is sort of experiencing some problems like this, and a lot of the problems are just from cesspool sewer water basically making it on the streets at king tides. And, you know, with sea level rise, it's just going to happen more and more and more often, you know, without pretty serious interventions to try to pump all this water out and sort of improve the sewer system and reduce backflow and things like that.
We saw that after Katrina when the chemical plants were flooded, and it was just terrible what happened down in Louisiana, New Orleans area there with the water incursions. It was toxic.
Yeah, really bad stuff. Even in some natural rivers, you know, there can be some pretty serious water quality issues associated with compound events like big tides and big rain events. But yeah, if you put it in a city center, you know, it's just going to get even worse in terms of the potential water quality issues.
Our whole system tries to prepare for a short emergency like a hurricane response, and we roll out people and supplies and sometimes the National Guard. But I worry we're really not prepared for a constant, relentless emergency that rising seas will bring. What could we do to get ready?
Well, there's a lot of things, I think, to try to get ready on a lot of different fronts. I would say the efforts are sort of being driven locally in terms of elevating streets or providing improved drainage or building walls or getting out of the way or doing beach nourishment. There's a lot of those different options in terms of, you know, local things that can be done to improve the situation with sea level rise. But another thing that I think it's really important to do is try to, you know, reduce the potential for global sea level rise via trying to reduce emissions. I think this lesson of flattening the curve that we're all experiencing in terms of susceptibility to viruses and things like that can teach us something about sea level rise or two. You know, what we showed in this paper is that when you're looking at impacts of sea level rise over time, the rate of sea level rise over time is really going to determine your susceptibility over time. So if you can flatten that sea level curve and try to get from high-end scenarios to more low-end scenarios, then that will be a big benefit in terms of buying you more time before you really experience a lot of impacts. So I think trying to do all those local efforts and trying to flatten the sea level curve by doing what you can to reduce emissions and coordinate and really tackle the problem together across governments is probably also a good idea.
Last question here, Sean. What will you be working on next?
So I will do a little bit more of these statistical models, but the main thing that I want to do and what I am doing going forward in the future is try to improve models for beach and cliff erosion. With the U.S. Geological Survey, I try to develop models to predict beach and cliff erosion because beaches and cliffs are kind of at the front lines of sea level rise and coastal hazard impacts. Beaches and cliffs often provide a nice buffer between the ocean and a lot of infrastructure. And so what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to develop what are called data assimilative models, basically models that integrate data of beach and cliff position to try to improve sort of the calibration and validation of those models. And we're trying very much to integrate those models with satellite observations. There are a lot of really nice Earth-observing satellites that have taken pictures of the Earth for decades. And so you really get a nice long record of what is the history of beach change at locations anywhere around the world. And so by combining satellite observations of coastal change with the models of coastal change, we can really improve the predictions of the fate of these things in the future. So that's something that I really hope to keep working on. And hopefully those results can help and make some difficult decisions about what we're going to do about sea level rise.
That would make a neat video if we could see kind of from the air the progression of sea level rise as it's already occurred on an iconic California beach and cliffside, and as it will occur and what it will look like.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a difficulty in this is that the beaches are very dynamic. They change with wave conditions and with seasons and things like that. But like you said, as we develop this archive of images over time and as sea level rise creeps up, I think we're really going to very soon be able to see the sort of long-term fate of a lot of beaches in terms of, you know, how these things really progress over time.
From the Pacific Coastal and Marine Science of the USGS, we've been speaking with oceanographer Sean Vatusek. Sean is co-author of the new paper, Sea Level Rise Exponentially Increases Coastal Flood Frequency. Find more information in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you for your help, Sean.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was fun.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. The skies are definitely clearer in many parts of the world as highways empty and billions stay home. In the short term, this is the first time most countries have seen any reduction in carbon dioxide emissions in decades. Only the collapsed Soviet Union saw lower greenhouse gas emissions during the early 1990s. Since then, it's been a huge carbon-burning bonfire where each year we increase climate-wrecking gases even more. The increase was increasing, and carbon dioxide levels went past 400 parts per million and currently sits above 415 parts per million. It needs to be at 350. Even with the reductions we can see, humans continue to add vast amounts of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. Even with a massive shutdown, we are still making the future more dangerous for ourselves and all creatures. Climate change is now so set in its way, even stopping all emissions would not be enough. We need to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere on a massive scale, if we can. Is your electricity still on?
Probably.
Does it come from burning coal or natural gas?
Probably.
Are there any planes in the air?
Yes.
Is there any traffic beyond electric vehicles?
Yes.
Are we cutting down tropical forests, the great carbon sinks?
More than ever.
Is the permafrost still thawing and Arctic ice retreating?
Yes.
Is natural gas leaking into the atmosphere?
We can see it from space.
The carbon machine is still running for billions of people.
Still running hard.
Very conservative experts predict only a 5% reduction in fossil fuel emissions due to COVID-19 pandemic and ensuing economic collapse. Since we increased emissions 3% last year and about 3% the year before, even a deep depression and collapse of international travel might take us back to emission levels of 2015 or 2016, which were substantially higher then in 2010, and at least 60% higher every year than humans produced in 1990. We have been on a binge. I have two things. One, don't be lulled into a happy place when you see some emissions are down. Two, this much is clear. We can never reopen the old economy heading for the old normal. The old normal was strangling the species, destabilizing the weather, and killing millions of people with heat. We can only afford to open a new chapter where everyone consumes much less, products are built to last, and the power comes from the sun, the wind, or water power. Let's take this time to plan for an economy in tune with nature. If that is impossible, we are impossible. Thank you for daring to dream. We could do much better. I'm Alex Smith. That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.
David Quammen, is the coronavirus the byproduct of human behavior?
Absolutely. There have always been viruses coming from animals into people, but it seems to be happening more frequently. It begins with things that we're doing to the natural world, intrusion, destruction, consumption, and that causes the spillovers. The spillovers turn into epidemics or pandemics because there are so many of us and we're so concentrated.
On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. A rising number of attacks by the Myanmar military on ethnic communities in the country have raised fears of possible war crimes and crimes against humanity there. UN-appointed human rights expert Yang Yi Li on Wednesday called for an investigation into events in Rakhine and Chin states, where she said that air and artillery strikes had killed and injured scores of adults and children. Armed conflict has taken place in Rakhine and Chin states since December 2018 between the Myanmar military known as the Tatmadaw and the Arakan Army. More than 157,000 people have been displaced, and hundreds, including women and children, killed and wounded since the conflict started. The Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Myanmar noted that calls for a ceasefire have gone unheeded. Instead, government soldiers have prevented injured people from accessing urgent medical care, Ms. Lee insisted, while men suspected of links to the Arakan Army have been detained and tortured. Schools, houses, and a Buddhist temple have been burned or destroyed, including an entire village of up to 700 homes, said the rights expert, who also called on the Arakan Army to protect civilians. People's data and privacy are unprotected in one-third of countries, and there has been a rise in cybercrime and online fraud during the COVID-19 pandemic, UN researchers said on Wednesday. In a survey on global cyber law, UN Trade and Development Agency UNCTAD found that while two-thirds of nations safeguard online data and privacy, an improvement since 2015, in least developed countries, only 43% of them do so. Here's Shamika Siriman, director of UNCTAD's Division on Technology and Logistics.
Cybercrime, the scams, online fraud, they are all on the rise. It's largely because, you know, we are now utterly dependent on digital tools to buy our food, buy, pay bills, to work, to get some education, and to connect with our friends and loved ones. So we are totally dependent on the digital realm. If the citizens are not protected, then subjected to all sorts of scams and online fraud. And these numbers are rising.
The UNCTAD data highlights how the fast-changing cybercrime landscape has proved a significant challenge to law enforcement agencies and prosecutors, especially for cross-border enforcement. But it notes that more and more countries are taking steps to reassure and protect online consumers with draft legislation that's expected to become law this year. These include Thailand and Brazil, which have based their legislation on European data protection laws, which are similar to those already in force in Australia, New Zealand, Korea, and South Africa. To Lao People's Democratic Republic now, where UN-appointed independent rights experts have urged the authorities to help communities affected by a dam disaster nearly 2 years ago. The breach of an auxiliary dam at the Zhejiangjie Lanoi hydropower project in July 2018 led to the flooding that killed at least 71 people and left thousands of others homeless. In a statement on Wednesday, the Working Group on Business and Human Rights said that survivors, who include vulnerable indigenous groups, had lost everything. They have yet to receive adequate compensation and live in inadequate temporary housing with little privacy and inadequate access to food, water, medical supplies, sanitation and land, the panel said, along with five special rapporteurs appointed by the Human Rights Council. Noting that the Lao government claims to be doing its utmost to help people, the experts said that this had been contradicted by reports that displaced communities are needlessly suffering. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. David Quammen, is the coronavirus the byproduct of human behavior? In interview with Omo Parenti, April 23, 2020. In his seventh week of sheltering in place in Milano, Italy, the filmmaker Omo Parenti called the science writer and explorer David Quammen. He was sheltering in his home in Bozeman, Montana. Omo had read Quammen's 2012 book, Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic, and he asked Quammen how he was able to predict 8 years ago the rise of the coronavirus pandemic. Omo Parenti is a member of A Thing By, a collective of young filmmakers based in Milano. David Quammen has won many awards for his books and magazine articles, including from the National Association of Science Writers. His work with National Geographic is best known. It has taken him on many difficult treks through the wild, such as chronicling J. Michael Fay's 2,000-mile survey hike through the forests of Central Africa, the Mega Transect. The conversation begins with David Quammen turning his computer sideways. He reveals a huge glass shelter in the sunlit corner of his study.
There's my snake over there in the tank. That's Boots the Python. He's sleeping right now.
Do you have other animals or just
a python? Yeah, we have, my wife and I live in this house with two dogs, a cat, and this python. So that's our family.
That's amazing. I know that it would take 500 pages to explain this, but do you think you could walk me through the main information that you had and used to deduct that this next epidemic was going to be the next big one?
Right. Yes. Some people have said, oh, nobody saw this coming. This is unpredictable. That's just not true. The scientists saw this coming. The scientist that I was talking to 10 years ago when I researched Spillover saw this coming in different pieces with different levels of probability. But if you took the consensus of the scientists that I talked to, the consensus would be this. Is there going to be a next big pandemic, a next big one, as I call it in the book? And they would say, yes, there will be a next big one. It'll be caused by a virus. That virus will come from an animal. What kind of an animal? Well, from a wild animal. What kind of a wild animal? Well, very possibly a bat. What kind of a virus? Well, a virus of the sort that evolves quickly, meaning maybe an influenza virus or a coronavirus. How would this virus pass into humans? Well, by contact, some kind of close contact between the wild animal and humans, or possibly through an intermediate animal. Where might that happen? Well, possibly somewhere where humans have contact with wild animals, including live wild animals, such as a wet market. Where? Well, possibly in China. So that was there. That was what I was hearing. That's what I put in my book. Was that predicting this? Well, to a pretty close degree, yes. Viruses are always unpredictable, particularly viruses that evolve quickly, like coronaviruses. They don't evolve as quickly as influenzas, but they evolve relatively quickly. So parts of this are unpredictable. But to me, the most unpredictable part of this whole crisis is how unprepared we were, many countries, Italy, the United States, for this event that the scientists warned us about with such accuracy.
Would you say that the information that was made available to you was also probably available to people who are in charge of making decisions?
Yes. This information was available. It's not just that I had private conversations with scientists 10 years ago and had the privilege of hearing this secret information. This was not secret. This was being published in scientific journals. Scientists were talking about that, not just to me. I've been talking about it as loudly as I can since my book was published in the U.S. in 2012, 2013 in Italy, I think. And this is all in journal papers, scientific publications, and the public health leadership in most countries knew about this, not just the scientists. So there were people in government, in higher levels of government. For instance, in the U.S., there was a directorate of our National Security Council devoted to pandemic preparedness. They knew about this. the people who led that knew about this on the National Security Council. What happened? Well, they knew about this. They were talking about this for years in the past. And then beginning with the Donald Trump administration, that directorate was closed down. Donald Trump didn't want to hear about this. He didn't want to spend money hearing about this. He didn't want to spend money being prepared for this. Likewise, at another American agency, the U.S. Agency for International Development, there was a big program designed to look for new dangerous viruses and create warning systems and response systems. That was closed down. So, yes, this information was not just available to political leaders. It was bouncing off political leaders for years in the past, and action, appropriate action was not taken.
So you think it was mostly economical, like it was related to the economics of preventing the outbreak, mostly?
Yes, it was, because political leaders don't like to spend money on something that might happen or might not happen during their term of office.
And I'm assuming that that's because it's inefficient to campaign about something that might not happen. It doesn't votes as much as other themes that might not. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And almost calling it inefficient is polite. It's risky for a politician to spend a lot of money on a program to defend against something that might happen, and then he's up for re-election in 3 years, and it hasn't happened, and his opponents are criticizing him. You spent, you know, X billions of dollars on pandemic preparedness, and we didn't have a pandemic. Politicians are scared of that. They don't want that to happen. Although we spend money on missiles and nuclear weapons and battleships and things like that, great weapon systems, we spend money on those, huge amounts of money, and we hope that those won't be used. We hope that those won't be necessary, and we're happy. We call it deterrence. Well, we need deterrence against pandemics, too.
It's interesting because it makes you think that our politicians almost spend more time campaigning to stay where they are than they do doing their work.
Excuse me, Olmo, did you say our political systems are flawed? Oh, my God. There are flaws. There are some flaws in our political systems, and not just in our political systems. Donald Trump was elected, so a lot of the fault lies on us, the American public. It lies on all of us because we haven't managed to educate the American electorate to critical thinking, to be able to see the difference between lies and reality and demagogic candidates and real leaders. You know, it was Winston Churchill, I guess, who said that democracy is the very worst system of government in the world, except for all the others. And we're seeing that.
When 9/11 happened, a single event on one side of the planet managed to change all security protocols in all airports of the planet. Ever since 9/11, whether you board a plane from China or the US or Europe, you get screened before you even get to the gate. And when you get onto a plane, the pilot's cabin is locked, which is something that we weren't doing before. Why was it that something like SARS in 2003 didn't achieve the same level of global cooperation on safety measures, for example?
Well, you make a very good point. SARS in 2003 was one of the warnings. It was a serious warning. It wasn't just an outbreak that killed 800 people around the world. It was a coronavirus. There was also MERS in 2012, another coronavirus coming out of the Arabian Peninsula with a high case fatality rate, but not so transmissible from human to human. And yet MERS got to South Korea in 2015 with someone coming back from Saudi Arabia, and it killed quite a few people in South Korea. Is that the reason that South Korea was better prepared than most countries for this? Maybe. But nothing like 9/11. You're right. However, this event should at least have the impact of 9/11 in terms of global preparedness. And as you rightly say, our airport safety controls, security controls, they're a form of preparedness against an event that might or might not happen. But you spend money and you cause people to go to trouble, standing in lines to go through airport screening. Millions of human hours spent on airport screening and a lot of financial resources to protect against the possibility that something might happen again, something as horrible as 9/11. And that was one bad event in one city affecting all the world. We should be ready to do that after this, once we get through this. We should use this event and learn from it. We're crazy if we don't act upon this event once we've got it under control.
Part of me thinks that had SARS happened in the United States instead of southern China, we would be seeing a different world right now, because it almost feels like we consider that part of the world too far from us culturally and physically. And had SARS happened in the United States, maybe even the World Health Organization would have acted differently on safety measures that every hospital in the world would have had to follow, the same way we did for 9/11.
It's a very good point, Omo, and you're very keen on this. And if I talked about it much more, I would give away my entire New Yorker piece.
My next question is about a lot of the epidemics and diseases that you describe in your book. And one way or another, in a lot of these diseases, it seems like patients end up facing some respiratory issues at some point. Now, this would make it sound pretty obvious that at some point, if we want to cure these people, we're going to need machines like ventilators in our hospitals. Why do you think there was such a big fear of running out of ventilators for patients if this is something that we could have predicted, we could have expected?
Very good point. We should have excess capacity in ventilators as well as hospital beds, intensive care units, and all that, because the diseases that spread around the world are more likely to be respiratory diseases than to be bloodborne diseases like Ebola. So those diseases move relatively slowly because they require contact with liquids, transfer of bodily fluids or whatever. To say that a lot of our worst diseases show respiratory symptoms in the victims, that's absolutely true, but you can look at it from the other end too. You can say that those diseases that cause respiratory symptoms are the ones that are most likely to spread around the world because they spread through the air. So any disease, whether it's the common cold, whether it's the year's influenza, whether it's COVID-19, any disease that spreads on the respiratory route, those are the ones that are most likely to be global pandemics. They might be highly virulent viruses killing a lot of people, or they might just be a relatively mild flu that spreads around the world, doesn't kill a very high percentage, but is extremely contagious. In either case, it makes sense to have excess capacity of ventilators. Why do we not have that capacity? Well, it's what I was talking about before. It's the fact that leaders, bureaucrats, are reluctant to spend money on excess capacity that may not be necessary, at least when it comes to healthcare. When it comes to military preparedness, we do it all the time. There's no excuse, really, for not having excess ventilators ready when a respiratory pandemic strikes.
What do you think dictates the levels of attention that we give to different topics in society? As in, why do you think a voter might be more inclined to voting for someone that builds excess capacity in the military sector but doesn't in the health sector?
Right. It's a curious thing. People have different thresholds for different kinds of risk. Some people say that people are reluctant to tolerate risk if it's something that they can't control. But if it's something that they can control, then they will tolerate risk. For instance, cigarette smoking. Everybody knows that that's risky. People still do it. People might be willing to tolerate the risk that they take by using tobacco, either cigarette smoking or chewing tobacco. It's dangerous. It can cause cancer. They tolerate that risk because they can choose it. But if you tell them grizzly bears, they're a threatened species and they're going to be protected by the endangered species list, and therefore there will be more grizzly bears that might be coming out of the mountains near their cows and their calves, possibly even where their children play, they will say that's absolutely unacceptable. I will not tolerate that risk. I will use chewing tobacco. I will drive my pickup truck down a gravel road at 75 miles an hour without wearing a seatbelt. That's risky, but I will not tolerate the risk of a grizzly bear near the place where I graze my cows. We all have anomalies like that. We all tolerate some kinds of risks and are unwilling to tolerate others. And that goes into our voting behavior, not just our private consumer choices and lifestyle choices. It's irrational. It's something that we have to accept. People's attitude toward risk is not rational.
Something that I've been hearing here and there is that because of mutations and because of Darwinism, the coronavirus will eventually get weaker in order to survive in our system. But you also explain why that might not necessarily be the case. Is that going to be the case with coronavirus? Is it going to get weaker the more we go forward and learn how to coexist with us?
Well, you're right. I explore that in Spillover, and people have heard that. Oh, viruses evolve to become less virulent, to become less vicious. in the human body and become milder. Sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't happen. It depends on the circumstances that the virus faces. So it remains to be seen what will happen with this virus. Coronaviruses are single-stranded RNA viruses, which means that they have a relatively high capacity to mutate, to evolve, to adapt. Not nearly as high as influenza viruses, which evolve very quickly for different reasons that I don't need to go into. But yes, this virus has the capacity to evolve. The evolutionary virologists that I've read so far on this are saying that this virus so far is not evolving, is not changing very much. Although it has a reasonably high mutation rate, is holding fairly steady in its genome to the way it was when it got into humans. Why would that be? Well, they say this virus doesn't need to evolve to be successful because this virus already happens to be so successful. It's spreading from human to human just great. It's gotten around the world in 2 months. It doesn't need to change its evolutionary strategy. It doesn't need to change its genome. It is succeeding. It will evolve more when it meets some challenges. What kind of challenges? Well, a vaccine, for instance. When we get a vaccine, that will be a challenge to the virus in terms of being able to transmit from one human to another. So with its relatively high mutation rate, it may evolve to get around the vaccine or to try to get around the vaccine. Influenzas do that. That's why we need a new influenza vaccine every year, because influenzas evolve so quickly. They can get around last year's vaccine. This virus is not going to evolve as fast as influenzas. And the scientists that I trust are saying that when we get a vaccine, that vaccine ought to be good for a while. It ought to be good for more than a year. But in terms of the virus evolving on its own to become less virulent, there's no reason to assume that that'll happen. Its life history strategy right now, and viruses do have a life history strategy, is working just fine. There is no reason to assume that this virus on its own is going to evolve to become less lethal than it is right now.
So not even by random chance?
It is randomly mutating all the time. There is plenty of random chance out there. It is throwing off different versions of itself every time it replicates. But unless there's an advantage in that particular change won't spread. It won't be selected by natural selection. As you say, it's Darwin. It's Darwin 101.
What I was really surprised about was reading in your book that the first SARS super spreader, a man named Professor Liu, started spreading the disease more than 2 weeks after he came in contact with the first SARS patient in southern China.
He was actually the second. He was the second super spreader. First super spreader was the poison king, the seafood merchant, from whom he probably got his case.
There you go. So in a way, we knew that with SARS, people were still spreading the disease even 2 weeks after they had encountered the disease for the first time. Mm-hmm. Now, why is it that the general assumption around the world is that the default time for self-quarantine is only 2 weeks? Why isn't it longer if we know that with SARS, it happened to spread after 2 weeks?
The answer is that we don't know. That's just a guess. And you're right. It's a guess that will be tested and is being tested, but it's not a guess that's been produced by really solid, you know, laboratory experimental data and deductions from data. It's an emergency guess.
It sounds like a bad guess. We know that it happens, that some patients go for more than 2 weeks.
But equally important is what you said about the silent spread. That didn't exist to any great degree with SARS. People spreading the virus before they felt symptoms. Even the man, Professor Liu, who carried the virus to Hong Kong, at which point he was very sick and he was coughing, maybe he was vomiting, and he was shedding virus. Obviously, he was symptomatic. But whether he was spreading virus for 2 weeks before that, we don't know. We don't think so until he became symptomatic. That was the difference between SARS, called SARS-1, and SARS-CoV-2, this virus. What makes this virus so successful in its own terms, in Darwinian terms, and so dangerous to us is this silent spread, this fact that people who are not yet symptomatic have been walking around, going to gatherings, riding the metro, going to work, and feeling fine, and yet they were shedding virus before they got sick. That is an extremely efficient strategy for a virus. And why does that happen? Well, they're just still speculating about this, but they're speculating that the first SARS primarily attacked respiratory cells in the lower respiratory tract. And so when people got very sick, then their lungs immediately started to fill because those cells were close to their lungs and their bronchiae, and they got crises and then coughing and vomiting and spreading the virus. But they weren't shedding virus before that because the cells were down low in their respiratory tract as the virus developed. Scientists are now speculating that this virus affects upper respiratory tract cells first, and from those cells, it can more easily spread not just on a horrible cough, but perhaps on an ordinary breath or on speech. And so people are walking around not feeling bad, but they've got virus replicating in their upper respiratory cells that are coming out of their mouths as they breathe and as they talk. That's what's so ingenious, quotation marks, about this particular virus.
This might sound like a rhetorical question to many, but is there a correlation between the way us as humans change the natural landscape and the number of new diseases that seem to be hitting us?
Absolutely. This disease is not an isolated event. This pandemic is not an isolated event. There have always been viruses coming from animals into people, but it seems to be happening more frequently now for a couple of reasons. And the first of those reasons is there are more humans, 7.7 billion humans now. We're hungry, we're smart, we're putting demands on the natural world for resources. We want timber, we want minerals, we want meat, we want water. We're putting all these demands on the natural world. We are coming in contact more and more with wild animals. Again, something that's always happened, but the scale now is different. All of those wild animals carry viruses. Some of those viruses are dangerous in humans. Some of them spill over into humans. And when they spill over into us because of the destruction that we're causing in the natural world, and they get into humans, then there's an opportunity. They get into us, first of all, because we are there and we represent an opportunity. The viruses don't seek us out. They just fall into us and they take hold, and that's an opportunity. If they can spread from one human to another, that's another opportunity. And it's a great opportunity for a virus because there are so many of us and we're so concentrated. We live so close together and we travel so much. So a virus that gets into a human can infect millions of bodies and spread around the world in a relatively short time. It begins with things that we're doing to the natural world: intrusion, destruction, consumption, and that causes the spillovers, and then the spillovers turn into epidemics or pandemics because of our connectedness.
What do you think is going to be the impact of coronavirus in Africa? There's a lot of talk about this right now.
I've been bracing myself for what's going to happen when this virus gets into the big chaotic cities of Central Africa, like Kinshasa of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or Brazzaville, or Harare. What's going to happen? I mean, the virus is already there, but it has been very minor so far. Not very many cases, not very many deaths. It seems to me that those places are just a big pile of dynamite waiting to blow up. And when that happens, I think it's going to be terrible for the people there. And I don't know why it hasn't happened yet. I feel like any day that we could start to see terrible numbers coming from Kinshasa. I hope it doesn't happen. If it doesn't happen, I have no idea why it's not happening, because it seems to me there's every reason to expect that it would happen. There are some brilliant scientific people. I know some of them. They're brilliant medical people, but they don't have the resources to control an outbreak like this if it really gets going.
Wouldn't it make sense for Western countries to help them with the resources in order to stop the pandemic? I mean, aren't we all in danger until we get it under control everywhere?
We absolutely are, but we've gotten so far behind the ball in places like Italy and the U.S. now that it's difficult for us to imagine sending medical resources anywhere, especially under Donald Trump, you know, America first. That's a horrible idea because these diseases are so globalized. They go everywhere. And nobody is really safe and healthy unless and until everybody is safe and healthy. And we're nowhere near that. Wealthy countries should be able to send help in a situation like this to countries with less resources.
I mean, it sounds like it would be selfish altruism, to use an oxymoron.
Absolutely. Now, I was looking for the right phrase. But you're absolutely right. Selfish altruism, it would be right and good, but it would also be smart for us to be doing that for our own sake as well as the sake of the people in Kinshasa.
What do you think are some of the most dangerous assumptions that we're making as humanity?
The most dangerous assumption that we're making is that we can continue with globalized, consumptive growth economies indefinitely. We can continue multiplying our population and consuming resources at the rate that we are doing and saying, great, the economy grew by 3% last year. The global growth curve is up and the national GNP is up. Terrific. Our economies are booming. That's the most dangerous assumption we can make, that we can continue that indefinitely. Because I believe, along with a lot of other people who are watching the impacts on the natural world and the way those impacts feed back to us, we who are part of the natural world, we see the problems. We see the loss of biological diversity, the climate change, and the increased jeopardy of pandemic diseases. And those things all reflect the fact that we're saying we've got 7.7 billion people. We're headed toward 9 billion people. That's just fine. We're going to feed everybody. Everybody's going to have a cell phone. Everybody's going to have a new jacket. Everybody's going to have new gym shoes once a year or more. And everybody's going to be able to eat lots of meat. And everybody's going to be able to fly and drive everywhere they want. There's going to be oil and other resources, all we want. We can keep continuing what we're doing. That's the most dangerous assumption that we're making.
It also makes me think about something else that you say in the book, which is one of the things that contributes to a pandemic's success or failure is people's behavior. Like, our behavior doesn't impact our future in any way, which is ludicrous. How do you feel about that?
I mean, I think that's true. When you talk about controlling behavior, then is it a matter of governments controlling behavior or world organizations controlling behavior, or each of us controlling our own behavior in terms of the decisions that we make? There are all those levels. And I think that the most important level is the individual choices that we make. That's where it all has to begin, in terms of how we choose to consume, what we eat, what we wear, how much we drive, how much we fly, how many children we have, if we have children, how we vote, whether we vote with the idea of the future in mind and other people in mind, or whether we vote simply on the basis of, well, how is this going to affect my income next year? All of those individual choices, that's the most important kind of control of behavior, controlling our own behavior. But it's difficult because we have a lot of poor people and they are desperate for food. And we have a lot of working poor people who are angry and scared. In the U.S., for instance, there are a lot of working people whose real income has gone down over the last 30 years, and they're angry, and they're worried, and they show it by voting for Donald Trump. So how do we solve that problem? I don't know.
It's almost like asking, how do you make a moderate version of capitalism? How do you slow capitalism down without making it collapse on itself?
And who is the model for that? Who is the model? Who is our exemplum for that? Is it Sweden? Is it Canada? I don't know. Those places are admirable in many ways, and yet can you turn Canada into the U.S.? Can you turn Sweden into Russia? No, you can't do it. You know, we have to deal with the realities that we have, which is lots and lots of people, suspicion, worry, desperation, disempowerment, anger, hunger, the wealth differential. We have to deal with all of those things, but I don't want to sound gloomy, hopeless. We can do all this. We can do all this. We can get through this pandemic, yes. Andrea Bocelli is still singing. People are still writing beautiful poetry and books and music and playing football, and also American football and baseball, and beautiful things are going on and people are able to hug each other. We'll get there. We'll get back to that. I hope we'll learn from this. I hope we'll learn from this, some of those bigger lessons in terms of our behavior.
That was a conversation with David Quammen, science writer and author of 4 books of fiction and 7 of nonfiction, including The Reluctant Mr. Darwin and The Song of the Dodo. He served as the Wallace Stegner Chair of Western American Studies at Montana State University. During this time period of the coronavirus, David Quammen is much in demand as writer for the New York Times and the New Yorker, and for online interviews. Thanks for this interview go to Elmo Parenti, member of a collective of young filmmakers based in Milano, Italy. They spoke on April 23rd, 2020. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.